And I've shared before the little story. I actually had an occasion to recount it this week at a family dinner of an occasion when 3 years ago, Lori and I got to fulfill a longtime dream, got to go on a vacation with our then single adult children to Disney World. And on the way back from Disney World, we were flying in. We had an intermediate stop in Houston. As we're landing, Toby was sitting on the other side of the plane, said, "Hey, Dad, look at this football stadium over here." And I looked out. It was a high school football stadium. He was impressed with it. And I was looking out. I looked across and looked through this window, and there's this little girl sitting there with her mom and dad, and she's obviously been at Disney World. She's all dressed in her Princess Disney World clothes. As I'm looking through the window right next to her, she slaps her hand up on the window and goes, "This is my window. You can't look out my window." And we had a little conversation, but her dad eventually said to me, "She's been told all week that she's a princess, and she's now impossible." You know, Disney is really good at selling the whole princess image, aren't they? You know, when you go there now, they have, you can actually take your little girl to a little place, and they do all the dress them up and the hair, and they do the whole thing. And they have, I remember going to one place at Disney World where all of the Disney princesses were there, and the little girls were just, oh, so big-eyed. But you know, have you paid attention to the princess stories? Cinderella was orphaned and then essentially enslaved by an uncaring and brutal family before she was finally set free through the glass slipper incident. Sleeping Beauty was cursed so that she went into essentially a coma, prolonged sleep, stayed that way for 100 years. She was mourned by her family, and her mother died of a broken heart mourning over her. Snow White's the victim of an insanely jealous stepmother who, through the use of a poisoned apple, puts her into a coma until she's saved by the handsome prince. The original Little Mermaid is really tragic. Ariel, despite making huge sacrifices for love, eventually ends up being spurned by the man she loves, who ditches her for another woman, and Ariel throws herself into the sea and turns into sea foam. Wow, there's a great story for you. Naomi Zacharias, who's an advocate for at-risk women, is the director of Wellspring International, says, "We want the good part of the fairy tale. We have only preserved the idea of happily ever after on the screen in our minds. We've rewritten the stories and forgotten about the battles." She's right. You know, why such grim stories? Grimm's fairy tales, yeah, I know. Anyway, sorry. Why are they so dark? You know, people being put into comas and, you know, all of this terrible stuff. And, well, maybe it's because they're trying to prepare kids for the reality of life. Battles are to come. That's one thing we can know for a fact. Life is always going to involve some difficulty and even some danger. And we're going to learn about that this morning as we look at Jesus' words that he uttered just a few days after he entered the city of Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, had the great, you know, acclamation, and this is now a few days later, just before he's going to be arrested and ultimately executed. Here's what he says to his men. Jesus went on saying, "In a little while you'll see me no more, and then after a little while you will see me." At this point, some of his disciples said to one another, "What does he mean by saying, 'In a little while, you'll see me no more, and then after a little while, you'll see me, and because I'm going to the Father'?" They kept asking, "What does he mean by 'a little while'? We don't understand what he's saying." Jesus saw that they wanted to ask about this, so he said to them, "Are you asking one another what I meant when I said, 'In a little while, you'll see me no more, and then after a little while, you will see me'? Very truly, I tell you, you will weep and mourn while the world rejoices. You will grieve, but your grief will turn to joy. A woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come. But when her baby is born, she forgets the anguish because of her joy that a child is born into the world. So with you. Now is your time of grief. But I will see you again, and you will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy. In that day, you will no longer ask me anything. Very truly, I tell you, my Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. Until now, you have not asked for anything in my name. Ask, and you will receive, and your joy will be complete. Though I've been speaking figuratively, a time is coming when I will no longer use this kind of language, but will tell you plainly about my Father. In that day, you will ask in my name. I'm not saying that I will ask the Father on your behalf. No, the Father himself loves you because you have loved me and have believed that I came from God. I came from the Father and entered the world, and now I'm leaving the world and going back to the Father. Then Jesus' disciples said, well, now you're speaking clearly without figures of speech. Now we can see that you know all things and that you do not even need to have anyone ask you questions. This makes us believe that you came from God. Do you now believe? Jesus replied. A time is coming, and in fact has come, when you will be scattered each to your own home. You will leave me all alone. Yet I am not alone, for my Father is with me. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I've overcome the world. So the first thing we can see in this passage is that the disciples were going to grieve, but would later rejoice. Now, they're initially a little bit confused. You know, Jesus says this, in a little while you'll see me no more, and then you will see me, and it sort of sounds like a riddle, now you see me, now you don't, now you do, now you don't, and it's like, what's going on? They don't really understand. They're a little confused about, well, a little while, like, how long are we talking here? And so Jesus essentially is saying to them what's going to happen. They don't quite get it yet. We get it because we have the perspective of history. He's saying, I'm going to be killed, and I'm going to be in a tomb, and you're not going to see me for a little while. I'm going to be gone. But the amazing thing is, I'm not going to stay gone. You will see me again after you don't see me, after I'm killed. Now, he says in verse 20, when that period when you don't see me, you'll weep. It's going to be tough. You're going to grieve. The world, however, will rejoice. Now, Jesus was exactly right. His opponents were thrilled because they got rid of Jesus, and they thought they'd done it pretty well. No riot ensued. You know, there was no big uprising. Jesus is gone, and they're happy because life now can go on the way it always has, minus one really irritating troublemaker from the sticks of Galilee. And so the disciples are devastated. Jesus is dead, but their opponents are thrilled. But Jesus says that's not going to be the end of the story. He said, what's going to happen to you is like a woman having a baby. Now, I watched Lori give birth to three children. And in a word, the process was terrifying. You know, you all know, the whole nine-month ordeal is just frightening, isn't it? You know, you start with, women could honestly say to their children, you make me sick, because that's how it starts, you know. They get morning sickness, and I remember Lori, in the end of the day, because she's going to make, in her case, it wasn't usually morning sickness, it was evening sickness. So time for dinner, she's going to go in and make dinner. She'd open the refrigerator and smell the odors coming out from the refrigerator. She'd turn this really interesting shade of green, close the fridge, and go into the bathroom, and her lunch would make an encore appearance. And it would be like, okay, I guess I'm cooking up some chunky soup for dinner again tonight, you know. I remember one time we had some friends over, a group of friends, and we all started talking about our favorite kind of pizza. And one of the guys said, you know, my favorite kind of pizza is shrimp pizza. Lori immediately got up, went to the bathroom, and threw up. Just, it's all it took. Great start to the thing. And, you know, eventually that gets better, but then come all those other interesting things. You know, their woman's internal organs just get pushed into little tiny corners that they didn't belong in, you know, and the bladder gets squeezed with some interesting results, and then they're not going to talk about the digestive things that go on, and then, you know, the back aches and the leg aches and the fluctuating hormones and the inability to sleep, and it's just a mess. And then comes the climax. The labor pains start. Oh my goodness, you know. Wait a minute, you mean there's a mini human being inside there and it's got to come out through that little tunnel? Is that possible? It looks like it'll hurt. Yeah, boy, not a rumor. Nothing like being in that room and your wife is yelling and screaming and looking at you with that, you did this to me look, you know. And then the baby is born. And there is a joy. All of the pain, all of the difficulty is completely forgotten because there is this joy that is so deep, you can't even begin to express it. And Jesus said, what's going to happen to you guys is like that. You're going to experience grief like you have never known before. Sadness that is to a depth you cannot imagine. You're going to be left with nothing but confusion and anger and indignation and disillusionment and hopelessness and a great paralyzing sadness over what happened to the best man you've ever known. But then suddenly it is going to be replaced, all of it, with a joy that cannot be limited and can never be taken away. All the sadness, all the confusion, totally gone. At the end of the Gospel of Luke, there's an incident where the risen Jesus is with the disciples, and he ascends into heaven, and it says, after that happened, and remember this, he's now leaving them. He's not saying, I'll be back in a little while. He's going to be gone. But in Luke 24:53, it says the disciples, they worshiped him, and they returned to Jerusalem with great joy. This is great. For the first time now, they really understood. They really got who he was. And they got what he had come to do. Now their whole paradigm of life had been changed. And most of all, they now knew that life after death is real. They'd seen it with their own eyes, and they knew that for them there was this great hope that nothing could ever take away, and that joy outweighed everything else. A joy that nothing could ever stop. So that's the first thing we see here. Second thing you can see in this passage is that the disciples would be loved by the Father. Verse 23 says, in that day you will no longer ask me anything. I tell you the truth, my Father will give you whatever you ask my name. Now this is kind of a reiteration of a promise we've seen before, just a couple of chapters earlier in John 14, where Jesus said, you know, ask anything in my name and I will give it to you. Only there's a little change here. Jesus says, you no longer have to ask me. You ask the Father and he will hear your prayers and he will answer your prayers directly. You're going to have the kind of relationship with God the Father that you have had with me, where you can talk to me about anything and ask me about anything, and now you're going to have that kind of relationship with the Father. Verse 27, he says, the Father himself loves you because you have loved me and believe that I've come from God. You're going to have this relationship with the Father where the Father loves you and is giving you the privilege to ask anything from him. In John 1:12, the apostle wrote, to all who received him, speaking of Jesus, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. You guys, you're going to be God's kids. This is the relationship that Jesus says you're going to have now. God's going to love you like his own children. You can ask anything of God. You know, not too long ago, Toby, my son asked me, he said, hey, Dad, have you finished your tax forms? And, well, almost. And I said, why? And he says, well, I need your tax information. I said, why? And he said, well, because I'm filling out the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid, or as I personally call it, the FCAW, the form formerly known as waterboarding. It's just awful if you've ever filled this thing out. So I hate that form. So he's filling this out because he's going to go to med school and he's applying for financial aid. And I said, well, Toby, you don't need my tax information. I mean, you know, you're married. You guys have been independent of us now for a couple of years, and we don't claim you as dependents. And, you know, why does the government need our tax information? I think he's got this wrong. He didn't. He had it right. They want to know our tax information. And they came back with a report that we are expected to contribute thousands of dollars to him going to medical school. Toby and Anna were thrilled. Lori and me, not so much. And I was like, you got to be kidding. But you know what? We're not going to be able to help here on this deal. But the reality is we'll do everything we can to help them because they're our kids. You know, you come and you say, Mom and Dad, anything you can help, we will help. If it's possible, we'll listen, we'll help, we'll do anything. A couple of years ago, Carissa, our daughter, had to move out of the apartment she was in, was moving into another apartment. And the moving date, the date when she could get into her new apartment and the date she had to get out of her old apartment, unfortunately fell right during a time when Carissa was scheduled to go visit Michael, who is now her husband, who was at the time deployed in Japan. And she said, Dad, what can I do? I don't know what to do. And we said, you know what, Carissa? You just go, and we will move you. And we did. She was out of the country when she moved. We did it for her. Now, you have to understand, I hate moving. I hate it with a passion. But we did it because she's our daughter. We want to have a relationship with even our adult kids where they could talk to us about anything. They could ask us for anything because we care so much about them. And Jesus says, that is the kind of relationship that you now are going to have with the Father because what I'm about to do. You know, I am as flawed and imperfect as any dad, but I can testify, as can most dads, that there is no way to express how deeply I love my children, how proud I am of them, how I delight in them, how I do anything to protect them and to care for them. So what you can do is do a little math here. You can take how much I love my kids, subtract all the selfish imperfection and flaws that are there because I'm a human dad, and then multiply that by infinity. And you've got the product is what God thinks about you. Now, the ancient Jews had some concept of that. In Psalm 103, verse 13, it says, as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. Isaiah 49, 15, God says to Israel, can a mother forget the baby she has born and have no compassion on the child she's born? Though she may forget, I will not forget you. However, the ancient Jewish people had a tendency to kind of view that as God's attitude towards the nation of Israel as a whole. The nation is his child, his son, if you will. When it comes to personally, they tended to see God as he's holy, majestic, which he certainly is, so holy they couldn't even pronounce his name. There's a little bit of distance, you know. They couldn't enter the Holy of Holies, the place where God dwells. They were unacceptable there. And so there was this sense of distance from them. And now Jesus comes along and says, all changed. So much so that Paul would say in Romans 8, 15, that by the Spirit we can cry out to God, Abba, which was their word for daddy. He's our dad. Most of us struggle with this idea that God could really love us like his own children because we're so fickle, so failing, and so faithless at times. But you know, I want you to think about this. Recently, my brother Jerry and Ann, his wife, and my mother reported that they attended the first birthday party of the most recent member of the clan, little JJ, who is Jerry and Ann's grandson, my mother's great-grandson. So his first birthday, they had a birthday cake for him. What do you suppose that little JJ did with the cake? He does what every one-year-old does with the cake at their first birthday party, right? He ate some of it, but the rest of it crumbles up on the floor, smeared all over his face, you know? That's what one-year-olds do. You know, we have a picture of Toby when he was about that age sitting in a bathtub because he had smeared chocolate pudding all over himself, you know. You look at that and you don't turn away in disgust and say, a child has an eating disorder or something, you know. What in the world is wrong with you? You eat the cake, you don't smear it on yourself, you don't throw it on the floor. You're just such a worthless thing. No, what you do is you take pictures and you laugh and you revel in this little child and their antics. And that's how God looks at you and me. Yeah, we don't do it all right. We can't even get the cake in our mouth a lot of the time, you know. And God just takes a picture and laughs and goes, that's my kid. Yeah, that's the one right there. The most important and life-changing thing that we can do, according to Ephesians 3:19, is understand and experience the love of God. Paul wrote in Ephesians 3:19, he prayed that we might know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure, to all the fullness of God. How do we get filled to the measure of the fullness of God? Paul says it is by knowing the love of God. That's what fills us up with the very character and life of God. You know, people get hung up on this passage. Jesus says, oh, Father's going to give you whatever you ask. And we addressed this back in chapter 14, the ask whatever you will in my name. We get hung up on what exactly does that mean, you know? And we miss the bigger point. The bigger point is Jesus saying, here is the relationship you're going to have with the Father, where you are his child and he loves you. And you can talk to him about anything, and he wants you to ask him about everything. What an amazing gift this is. Well, wow, this seems like really good news so far. Yeah, there's going to be some sorrow, but then there's going to become great joy and rejoicing. Nothing can ever change. And then you're going to have this relationship with the Father where he's going to love you. This is really cool. And then Jesus lets the other sandal drop. Here's the next thing he says, and that is that the disciples are going to have some trouble, and we will too. In this world, you will have trouble. Now, the disciples are pretty excited about what they're hearing here as Jesus is talking about this relationship. And it's interesting, verse 30, they say, this makes us believe you came from God. Really? You finally got it, Einstein? And have you ever noticed when, you know, Einstein was a genius, but when people use his name to refer to someone, they mean the exact opposite. Have you ever noticed that? You know, when your wife keeps telling you something, you think it's wrong, and she keeps saying it, you know, and then you think, no, that's not right. And then all of a sudden you realize it's right, and you go, oh, you know what? I see what you're saying. You're right. And she goes, finally you got it, Einstein. It doesn't really mean you're that smart, you know. What she's really saying is, how dense is that block of wood on top of your neck, you know? These guys have been with Jesus, and they say, oh, well, now what you're saying makes us believe you came from God. Well, the time he stopped a storm in its tracks by saying, could you just stop? That didn't give you a clue? You know that time when he came walking across the water on the lake, you didn't think that was a little out of the ordinary? Or just a few days earlier when he raised Lazarus from the dead, you didn't sort of think, okay, that's really not normal. Jesus had to be thinking, I've got a whole football team of Einsteins here, you know, 11 of them. Oh, now we believe you're from God. Dude, what took so long? Verse 31, Jesus says, you believe at last. You know, don't you wish you could have been there to hear how that, I mean, you know, that comes across in text. You don't really know his tone of voice, but don't you think he must have been going, well, you believe at last. Finally, Einsteins. Man. They finally got it. But he's happy about it. But as soon as he says that, in verse 32, he says, well, this is really good. I'm glad you got it. However, you got a few more hurdles still. Because very soon, all of you are going to be scattered and you are going to abandon me at the most crucial hour. You're going to bail. Now, it's interesting that Jesus says, I told you these things so that you might have peace. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? Can you imagine how the disciples felt after they bailed out on Jesus that night? Man, oh man. The guilt and the self-condemnation must have been enormous. You know, when they saw him risen from the dead and they remembered, wow, you know, when he needed us most, we just ran. Ooh, that must have felt bad. And Jesus says, he's telling them this ahead of time so that they can be at peace. He's saying, look, I want you to know I know all about it. I knew about it before it was happened, and that doesn't matter. I love you anyway. That's why I'm telling you this now, so that when everything is done, you can accept that you can be at peace, because I knew what was going to happen and it was okay. Isn't that cool that Jesus did that? But then he says, what you need to understand is that in this world, after all this is done, you are going to have some trouble. That's the nature of this world. He says, I want you to have courage, to take heart. Literally, the word means to have courage, to dare, to be bold. He wants his followers, when the troubles come, and they are going to come, for these guys, they're going to face a lot of trouble. He says, I want you to continue to be bold, to dare. And that's what God wants of us as well. What happens so often when we experience troubles in our lives, I experience this, I've done this, and I see Christians do it all the time. Something bad happens, and it continues to happen, and stretches out over time, and we start going, well, I feel like I'm cursed. Whatever I want, I get the opposite. You know, poor me. I feel sorry for me. You should too. Personally, I think God has just abandoned me. I don't know if he was ever there in the first place. I sure can't trust him anymore. Boy, that's so common among Christians. And this could easily have happened to the disciples. I mean, you know, these guys believed in Jesus. And after his death and resurrection and ascension, they continued to believe him. And what happened to them was awful. They were opposed, rejected, persecuted. And all of them except for John ultimately were martyred. They were all killed. John was tortured and exiled. And it could have been very easy for them to say, well, thanks a lot, Lord. You know, I try to serve you, and this is what I get. It's just awful. They could have just gone to the corner and sucked their thumbs because life was so hard for them, but they didn't. They did what Jesus wanted them to do. Take heart. Be bold. Dare. He wants them to understand that this is part of life in this world. You know, in my younger days in high school and for 2 years in college, I tried to play baseball. I mostly practiced a lot and didn't get to play in the games. And, you know, it was because of the unfair standard the coaches had. They expected players to have some talent, and I didn't seem right, and I didn't have any. But that was how it went. But especially in college, our coaches did a lot of work on hitting, on us, you know, getting our swing down, so we didn't have to think about the swing, we'd just think about the pitch. And so we would go and they would have us do soft toss drills where you'd team up with another guy and he would get about 10 feet away and he'd just underhand just toss the ball up and you'd have to practice your swing and do it over and over and over and over. And then you'd go in the batting cage and they had these pitching machines and they'd, you know, the pitching machines, just you'd hit off the pitching machines over and over and over again. Then came those times when actually you had a game and they would put you in the game and you'd get in the game against a live pitcher from the opposing team. You know what? Those guys were absolutely Machiavellian. You know, they wouldn't just softly toss the ball up there so you could hit it like you'd been practicing. And they wouldn't even do what pitching machines do. Pitching machines mostly just, you know, kind of threw the same kind of pitch all the time at pretty much the same speed. These guys get up there on the mound, and they would change the speeds at which they threw. And they would throw inside, they'd throw outside, they'd throw high, they'd throw low. And then they'd do some really evil things. They'd put spin on the ball so it actually would change the trajectory as it came to the plate, a curveball or slider, just not nice, you know? And occasionally, you know, they would, they'd throw a pitch, they'd kind of lose control of it, and it would come right at you. And if it hit you, it hurt. In fact, it could do some damage. And so, you know, this whole thing, when you get up there against a real pitcher, was downright discouraging at times, because most of the time, you fail.
You know, you swing the bat, you don't hit the ball solidly, you foul it off, or you miss altogether, or you hit a stupid weak ground ball or a pop fly, you know. It was humiliating. So here's the thing. Since I was a wannabe player, do you think that I said, wow, you know, the last thing I want to do is have to get in a game and hit against an opposing pitcher because it mostly involves some failure and a little bit of danger. I would much rather be out there in the batting cages doing the soft toss thing, you know, safer, and I can do that pretty well. Is that what you do? No. All of that stuff was so that you can get in the game against the pitcher because that's when it really counts. So here's the thing. As a follower of Christ, when the difficulties come, when the troubles come, that's the game. That's when the faith really comes into play. And all the other stuff that we do in life is preparing us for that. And that's what we forget. Jesus gave us a reason for boldness. He said, I have overcome the world. That's why you can be bold and dare when the difficulties come. When Jesus died on that cross, it looked for all the world like the world had won. It had defeated Jesus. He was nothing more than an innocent, helpless victim. That's how it looked. It's not the truth. Because Jesus conquered death and showed that that whole experience was in fact part of his plan all along. When the world thought it was defeating him, all it was doing was playing right into his plan so that he would bring about the greatest victory ever in the history of the human race. This is what we need to remember when we're in those difficult days, when we think it's hopeless. No, it isn't, because Jesus has overcome the world. He has won the victory. Recently, I saw an example of what I'm talking about here. You all know that Dan and Josie Jacobs have just recently suffered a real loss, a real heartache in their lives, and this is not the first time for them in the loss of their little daughter, Madeline. A few days after that, Josie sent out a message to those closest to them, and I was amazed what she said in that message. Here's what she wrote. We've received so much love and support from all of you and from our Anchor Church family to help us get through this tough time. The evidence of God has been everywhere we turn during this process. And she went on to say, we have felt the presence of God with us the entire time. That's dealing with loss and trouble in life and winning the victory. Because right there, God is honored and glorified by their faith. What a powerful, what a bold statement that makes. Not only to all of us who love them, but to the world around them, and to even in the unseen spiritual realm, that is a loud and resounding win for God. So what do we do with this? How does this apply to us? Well, first thing is, don't be surprised by trouble. There's two things about this world that we need to remember. First of all, it is a fallen, broken world. It has been since Eden. And the curse that resulted from the fall brought with it hardship, pain, loss, disappointment. And no one, not one man, not a woman, not a Christian, not a non-Christian, not a lucky person, not an unlucky person, no one is going to go through this life without experiencing the troubles of life in a broken world. That is how it is. You know, we have this curious propensity of thinking, well, everything ought to work right, and everyone ought to be like they ought to be, and things should go the way I want. And we act like when that doesn't happen, it's weird. It's like, what's gone wrong? Nothing's gone wrong. That's how the world is. You know, do you think something has gone wrong when weeds crop up in your garden? No, that's life in our world. There's weeds here. That's part of it. That's the way of life in a broken world. Job 5:7 says, man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upward. You know what? Sparks do fly upward. Go have a bonfire. Toss a piece of wood into the bonfire. Up come the sparks. As surely as that happens, as surely as you are born to trouble. That's life. Psalm 90, verse 10 says, the length of our days is 70 years or 80. If we have the strength, yet their span is but trouble and sorrow. It's what drives me crazy about the health and wealth gospel people. It's like, have you read the Bible? You know, look at what it says. Here's what it says. In this world, you're going to have trouble. That's how it is. So don't be surprised by it. And the second thing we always need to remember is you have an enemy. If you're a follower of Christ, Satan does not want you glorifying God, and he will do anything and everything to keep you from doing it. And if you're going to go and be like the apostles and tell people about Jesus, he is going to try to destroy you. If you try to obey God, there's going to be trouble because you've got an enemy who's going to try to stop you. Broken world, influenced by Satan, man, there's going to be trouble in life. So what do we do with that? Well, we're not surprised by it. So our response to it is this. Be bold. I don't know if you've heard, I like the, there's a little clip, there's a little ad for the movie, for the TV show NCIS, where one of the characters does this Sean Connery imitation, being James Bond, you know, I like to live dangerously. I love Sean Connery, you know, that's what God's, I like to live dangerously, be bold, take it on. You know, in his novel, Jaber Crow, Wendell Berry depicts a character in the fictional town of Port William. This character's name is Roy Overholt. And Barry describes him this way. He says, he is a man who is merely not present. In all of his life, he never did anything that surprised Port William. I don't think he ever surprised himself. As a rule, when the pressure was on, Roy eased away. He was not by nature a man who was very much in evidence. That is not what God wants for us. He doesn't want us to be people who are not by nature in evidence. We just ease away from pressure and just try to keep below the radar. Be bold. We have reason to be of good cheer. The passage gives us great reasons. We have joy. We have been given the greatest gift you could ever give. We have been given eternal life through Jesus Christ and the certainty of it by his resurrection. Man, that's everything. It changes everything. We had a reminder of it this week in our family. My mother's brother, my Uncle Merle, my favorite uncle by far, died suddenly this week. I guess you could say suddenly. He was 89, so I don't know if, you know, that it's not totally unexpected, but there was no indication. He just laid down, went to sleep, and was gone. You know what? It's heartbreaking. Uncle Merle's been there all my life. And I kind of have, you know realistically he's not going to live forever, but I sort of have just thought he's always going to be there. Now he's gone. But here's the great news. He's not gone forever. He's with Jesus. And someday I'm going to see him again. That's great news. That's something to be joyful about. So we need to remember that. And second, we need to remember we have this relationship with God. You know, God is our Father, and we go around and we quote so often the 23rd Psalm, some of the greatest verses in all the Bible. Psalm 23, verse 4, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. No evil, for you are with me. Yeah, that's right. The Father is with me. Well, yeah, but bad things happen. Yeah, they do. But Jesus has overcome the world. I will have trouble, but my trouble is not meaningless, nor is it hopeless. And God will be with me to give me strength in the midst of it. And here's the thing we need to understand. My troubles and your troubles are an opportunity. They are our at-bat. This is the time when we can really display the glory of God and his power and his majesty as we walk in faith in him. You know, recently Lori and I were in Islands Restaurant. Some friends had given us a gift certificate to Islands. I love Islands. And so that was a great gift. We went to Islands, sitting there, and they have in Islands these screens all over, you know, where they display pictures, films of people surfing. And, you know, inevitably, these guys are surfing on these really big waves, you know, usually head high or more. And it's just mesmerizing to watch, isn't it? When you watch a really good surfer and they're just carving up a big wave, it's like, wow, that is, it's beautiful. It's, you know, it's just, it's artistic and it's just impressive. It's also hard, you know, paddling out when the surf gets that big, it's scary. Personally, I've tried surfing. My ideal surf is somewhere between ankle and knee high, you know, about like that, you know, because it's easy. You get over the wave, you know, ah, okay, no problem. You know, when you get over the big waves, it's like, oh no, you know, board goes, you slam, things, what happened? Where's my board? Oh yeah, there it is. Good. All right, I know. Get it back on and start paddling out again. Then bam, you get hit again. This is not fun. But here's the thing. There's really not much of a thrill in surfing an ankle-high wave. I mean, it's kind of fun. You know, you get up and it's like, okay, we're tooling along here and now it's dead. That was it. I was on it for 3 seconds and like, yeah, that's it. Really, and nobody goes, wow, look at that guy. That wave's a foot high. He's surfing it. Ooh. Not very impressive. Not really all that fun. Man, I would love to be able to get out there and surf those head-high, double overhead waves and do all that stuff. I'm never going to be able to until Jesus comes back. Then I can. But anyway, but here's the thing. We need to recognize that when the troubles come, that's the big day. That's when we get to get out and surf the big waves. That's when it matters. That's when, most of all, we need to say, you know what? I have the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That gives me joy no matter what may happen. I have a relationship with the Father where he's with me, and Jesus has overcome even this. He is not abandoning me. He is with me in this, and somehow there's meaning in all of this, and the thing that I can do most of all is I can have victory by continuing to trust and obey God in the midst of this difficulty. That glorifies him more than anything else I can do. So let's surf the big waves. Let's close in prayer.